Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hello again, this is Dan Godby, medical editor of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. Thank you for joining us for the summer 2021 edition of the JSOM podcast. In this issue, I will identify some articles that are worth reading that are not covered in this podcast. Shower's article on blood product administration has some interesting potential trends seen in its data. McGuire's survey of tranexamic acid utilization and tactical emergency medical support is very much worthwhile for medical support of law enforcement teams. Tin's article on chemical warfare agents and terrorist attacks is an excellent review of the topic with great insights as guidance for future training. We at the JSOM are always interested in hearing from our readership, especially those of you in the primary positions like medics and battalion surgeons and PAs. I'd like to reiterate our recently developed mentoring program specifically to help medics get through the publishing process. A select group of editors are dedicated to concentrate on articles submitted by medics and provide assistance in getting them published. Now, once again, here's Josh and Alex with the podcast.
Josh, what's going on with you, my friend, these days?
Alex, welcome to the summer 2021 episode of the JSON podcast. I am doing nothing. I mean, I'm working, but, you know, it's about all. You can do anything exciting?
Well, you know, I'm theoretically being effectively utilized by our nation's armed forces, and so trying to learn a new language, doing some writing. Hopefully there will be some publications out of that with the JSON. And most importantly, through our scientific analysis, I have been able to scientifically analyze flushing toilets south of the equator, and they do not go in the opposite direction, counter to the common myth.
They don't. So they go the same way as everybody else's toilets go.
Yep. Fun with toilets. And that was one of them. So, you know, well, that I actually grew up on a sailboat overseas. And so speaking of fun with toilets, it actually reminded me of when I was a kid and my dad one night dragged me into the toilet in our small sailboat and turned off the lights. And I was really confused and a little worried about what was happening next. And he ended up pumping the saltwater toilet, and there was some bioluminescence from the plankton overseas, and so it looked like a acid trip through a nebula, looking at the toilet with all the bioluminescence. That was really fun, and may have even been more fun than flushing a toilet here, but you can always have fun with toilets.
Oh, man. I mean, this is what the people listen for, Alex, is this hard-hitting scientific discussion. Yeah. Of toilets.
I like that you think people listen.
Well, since they listen, we should probably talk about the articles we're going to talk about, right?
Yeah, and I think you're going to send the first one. What you got for us?
Yeah, so the first article is a case report of infectious myositis in an austere setting by, and I apologize if I screw up your names, Doctors Sakastian, Slatton, Roberts, and Powell. I apologize to the first one. So they discussed a case of a 33-year-old female, and she presented to a Roll 3 with a nonspecific left lateral thigh pain. And during this workup, they discover through both CT, ultrasound, and clinical findings that she had a case of infectious myositis, which sometimes in a non-deployed setting can be a little bit difficult to deal with, but overseas presents some interesting challenges. So I really appreciated in this article that they showed the ultrasound imaging and the CT imaging of the patient, and then they compared it to what a normal person would look like. And this is really good that you can go take a look at this and sort of start building the repertoire in your mind of what normal looks like, but also what some signs you could look for while you're overseas. I think the second really important discussion in this article is their use of antibiotics. The standard practice for dealing with infectious myositis is vancomycin, because it's presumed to be MRSA, that especially with this patient, she had had some sort of traumatic injury and likely some MRSA from her skin seeded her muscle tissue. But dosing vancomycin requires daily monitoring of vancomycin levels to make sure you're getting appropriate therapeutic response from the dose you're giving them, and you adjust your dosage based on the daily labs, and it's all very interesting. But they were overseas, and they didn't have the ability to run these daily VANC levels. And so they went back and forth, and they finally decided on linezolid, which is a big gun, but it got the job done for this patient. And also for this patient, they only did 3 or 4 days of IV antibiotics, because the linezolid, when you give it orally, is also bioavailable at the site of the infection, which is not true of vancomycin. Vancomycin does not distribute systemically if you give it PO. So they only gave her 4 days of linezolid IV and then transitioned to PO, which is great. It's much easier to give. And we need to remember as providers that while IV antibiotics are excellent, they do the job for certain indications. If you can give them an oral antibiotic and they tolerate it, it's really easy for the patient to do and dose, and they don't need to have IVs in, and it's all great. However, we should also remember that we need to educate our patients on the side effects of those antibiotics, because you don't want somebody like stopping their course of antibiotics like halfway through because their stomach hurts. And then lastly, I want to say the authors do a really excellent job on giving some really fantastic education on myositis. Their whole first page or two is just discussing the various types of myositis, how they present, the stages they go through, what you need to look out for, and ways of treating that. And I think that was a really nice addition to this article, and it provided some really great education. So I'd advise all of you to go check out this article. Go look at the imaging. Go read about myositis. It's not something you're going to see every day, and it's probably not something you're going to see hardly at all. It's one of those diagnoses that we need to keep in the back of our mind, because it can turn real bad real fast.
Yeah, I thought they did a great job. I really enjoyed it. And this brought to mind a couple of different things, which is what we started talking about last time, that despite the fact that we focus on trauma as military medical providers, the overwhelming majority of what we're going to be seeing is non-trauma. I think the JTS data shows about 90% of our evacuations from theater are actually non-trauma. And this is just a great reminder. And I don't have the paper in front of me, so Josh, you're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they ended up using the Advisor Telemedicine Critical Care Service for their antibiotic selection, which is just such a great option. We actually called them here recently and just really enjoyed having that capability. Can't recommend it enough for those folks out there.
Really excited this edition to have as our guest editor, Dave, a reserve PJ from Arizona. Privileged to be able to chat with you again, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Alex. Just want to say thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And super fun on my end to be able to chat with you again. So really excited to have you here this edition. And which manuscript are you reviewing for us?
So the article that we're going over today is titled Autopsy Determined Atherosclerosis in Elite U.S. Military Special Operations Forces.
Yeah, which is a great one from our good friends Maz and Dr. Coatwall. They always do great work. And what type of research is it?
It's an original investigation.
Got it. And so what is the gap in the literature that they are looking to answer?
So the gap in the literature that this article aims to support is the prevalence of premature atherosclerosis in the U.S. soft troops.
And so this is an interesting topic on atherosclerosis. Dave, would you mind giving us a bit of a refresher on the pathophysiology of this?
Yeah, for sure, Alex. So for those of you that haven't cracked the cardiac Bible in a while, just a quick refresher. This medical condition is the buildup of fats, cholesterol, and other substances in and on your artery walls. This buildup is typically called plaque. And the plaque can cause your arteries to narrow, blocking blood flow, and therefore making your heart less efficient and reducing its ability to compensate when in shock. The plaque can also burst, leading to a blood clot. And although it's often considered a heart problem, it can affect arteries anywhere in your body.
Got it. That's helpful. Thanks. And so what was the clinical question that they attempted to answer?
So reading through it, I'm not exactly sure they specifically attempted to answer a question, but rather open the door to a discussion of whether or not premature plaque buildup could be a significant, somewhat avoidable health risk of our soft troops.
And so in the methods section, how did they organize their research?
So it was a retrospective study, and it was of all SOF personnel that died due to combat-related injuries from the years 2001 to 2020. And it's important to note that all combat-related fatalities in the study had undergone a comprehensive autopsy examination conducted by a board-certified forensic pathologist.
Got it. And so what did they find with their results?
So it's actually pretty interesting. In the study, there are 356 heroes or deceased personnel included in the research. And of the total 388 fatalities that occurred during the study period, 32 were excluded and 14 lacked documentation. 13 had an extensive traumatic injury and 5 had their heart removed for donation. And the mean age was 31 with a range of 19 to 57 years old. And almost all at 98.6% were male. And the overall prevalence of premature atherosclerosis in the study was 17.4%, of which 24.27% were over 30 years old. And the prevalence of coronary atherosclerosis alone was 13.8%.
That is surprising. And so what did they note in their discussions section?
So they noted that there's various known risk factors discussed in the article, such as hypertension, dyslipidemia, smoking, diabetes, and obesity. And one of the most relevant potentially being the acute and chronic stress experienced by the average operator in both training and combat through the course of their career. Despite this stress being unavoidable in such an intense profession, the DoD has put forth significant funding and efforts to ensure that our elite troops remain combat ready, both physically and mentally.
And so what was the author's conclusion in the manuscript?
So ultimately, the authors concluded that autopsy determined atherosclerosis is prevalent in SOF personnel, despite young age and positive lifestyle benefits of service in an elite military unit.
Interesting. So moving on from your summary of the article more to your analysis, what did you note were some of the strengths of this article?
So a few of the strengths. First off, the authors identified that relevant info from the hero's past medical history and prior lifestyle choices could have helped better explain plaque levels at the time of death. Some of the desired pertinent info included whether or not they smoked, used smokeless tobacco, past history of sleep deprivation, performance-enhancing supplements, dietary factors, stressful environments, and extreme exposure to physical stress. Another good strength was the article highlighted that chronic physiological stress is believed to contribute to cardiovascular disease in European countries, but that the U.S. doesn't generally acknowledge stress as a clinically meaningful risk factor. And third, the authors do a great job of digging deeper into a topic that much of military medicine seems to overlook, which is overall cardiovascular health among outwardly healthy operators.
Yeah, that's a great point. And so, of course, with any scientific manuscript, there's always room for improvement. So did you note any specific weaknesses in this research?
Yeah, and a few, I'll list them out. So the first one being that in order to accurately represent special operators in a study, it should not have included support personnel. The second being that the article briefly spoke about Army Special Forces having a higher prevalence of plaque buildup, but didn't dig deeper as to why. And third, the authors could have done a better comparison between the prevalence of premature atherosclerosis in SOF personnel and civilians of similar demographics.
Yeah, what a great point. And so overall, what's your summary of where this research and manuscript fits within the existing literature?
So overall, great article, very insightful. The study has a 2-Charlie level of evidence based on their criteria.
Right on. Well, a privilege and a pleasure again to get a chat with you, Dave, and look forward to seeing you out in the field sometime soon.
Yeah, likewise, Alex. Thanks for having me.
From the E4 Mafia with their new intranasal antihistamine, now enhanced with nicotine and caffeine. For all of you stationed out in those dusty, terrible places with ongoing allergies, get everything you need all in one snort. Antihistamine, nicotine, and caffeine.
Mm.
next article we've got is 23.4% hypertonic saline, a tactical option for the management of severe traumatic brain injury with impending or ongoing herniation, from a whole slew of authors that are much, much smarter than you and I, Josh, just throwing it out there. First author is Eric DeSouci, friend of the show, as well as Dr. Kasich, Dr. Stack, who we'll be interviewing later on, med student Chris Peters, who is also a technical sergeant PJ, Dr. Vanwick, who I think we all know and love well from Fort Bragg, and of course, the illustrious Doc Dorsch and Doc Rush from the PJ world. And Dr. Rajiji. So this article is a systematic review, and in the author contributions, what's noted is that Doc Rush came up with the idea for the use of 23.4% saline in the pre-hospital environment for military medics, and then a number of the authors provided the literature review, and being that this is a systematic review, they summarized some of the existing articles that were out in the community writ large, and so that includes some case reports and some case series, as well as some benchtop and preliminary data. They then go on to compare that with the existing TC3 guidelines in terms of its use for 3% hypertonic saline and some of the pros and cons, and then finally wrap up with a recommendation that going forward, and I'll quote here, current combat medic TBI treatment algorithms should be updated to include the use of 23.4% hypertonic saline as an alternative to 3% and 5% solution, given its effective and tactical advantages. So we'll be asking the author a few more questions, but before we do that, Josh, let's go into our quality assessment checklist, and which one are we going to be using this time?
So we're going to be looking at the University of Oxford's critical appraisal tool for the systematic review. So are you ready, Alex?
Send it, bro.
What question did the systematic review address?
So they attempted to answer the question of if 23.4% hypertonic saline is appropriate for the pre-hospital military medic environment.
Is it likely that important relevant studies were missed?
So I will say in reviewing this article, it does appear to be a weakness that this is a systematic review that did not use the typical PRISMA method that we are used to seeing. And so I was disappointed from a reviewer perspective that that wasn't picked up during the revision process. So I don't know.
Well, then this might not be applicable, but were the criteria used to select the articles for inclusion appropriate?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Were the included studies sufficiently valid for the type of question asked?
We have a question for the author along those lines.
And were the results similar from study to study?
I think so. What do you think?
I don't know. They looked at a ton of different articles. I mean, it wasn't all for one thing. They looked at essentially like defining the size of the medication and comparing it to the size of other hypertonics. And then they looked at if it was going to damage the vein, if you administered it through a peripheral vein. And then they looked at the side effects that you sometimes get with rapid administration. It was an attempt to sort of start the process of discussing the fact that maybe you don't need to carry the hypertonics in the 500 ml bags. So I don't know.
I think you may be forgetting that the quality assessment checklist is supposed to be rapid fire.
Well, you asked me a question and I wasn't prepared to give you a yes or no. I mean, like, what do you think, Alex? Like, it's an interesting take. It's an attempt to try to like lessen Cuban weight for special operators when Cuban weight is a huge issue.
So, you know, you and I were talking before the recording about some of the really unique tools that some of the soft medics have thrown out on the prolongedfieldcare.org website about using 23.4% and 3%. There's a lot of good ideas out there. I applaud these authors for trying to do a more structured, formalized, and frankly, academic approach to it, which is really heartening to see. And so I'm just not used to seeing it in this particular structure. It's neither good nor bad, just different. And I think we'll hopefully get some more information from one of the authors here in a few minutes to clarify some of those points.
Thank you.
Well, Josh, to answer some of those questions we have about the manuscript, we have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Brian Stack today, who is well into his anesthesiology residency and has the distinction of being a former pararescueman from the Air Force. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks, Alex. I really appreciate the opportunity. Really appreciate what you guys are doing, and just thanks for letting me be on.
Yeah, really excited to glean a little bit more information, background, and thought process from you and your author counterparts about this very interesting manuscript. And so jumping right into the questions, looking at our first question to you, it's that your systematic review, which is level 3A evidence, appears to be based mostly on case series, which are level 4 evidence. Do you think that this data is strong enough to change practice before we have prospectively collected randomized trials?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. It's always important to consider your level of evidence when you're supporting any hypothesis. However, the team and I would like to clarify that this article, it wasn't intended to be a systematic review or a formal systematic review, but rather an editorial kind of to start the conversation and inform our community on the safety of hypertonic saline and how it can safely be used in the pre-hospital setting. You know, a systematic review usually includes a method section. If you're really going by strict criteria, and you'll notice we didn't include that in our paper. So this is more of a less formal, we wanted to look and kind of appraise previous work by some other authors and review the safety of administering 23.4% hypertonic saline through peripheral access IVs in the treatment of impending herniation. So I just want to conclude with, oftentimes in medicine, we must make decisions based on the data we have available. And many times that relies on expert opinion and some lower levels of evidence. And I think that there's a little of that with what we've done here.
Got it. That's helpful. Thank you. And our next question for you is that you note in your manuscript that there are no randomized pre-hospital studies that exist regarding the use of 23.4% hypertonic saline. And in reading through your manuscript, I think it appears that there are also no randomized in-hospital studies about 23.4%. Is that correct?
Yeah, I agree, and the team does as well. And I believe overall that's true. There are a few retrospective studies looking at 23.4% hypertonic saline, and a little bit less quality of evidence. However, I think it's demonstrated in multiple studies that its overall effectiveness in treating increased cerebral pressure and kind of staving off impending herniation. The overall effectiveness of hypertonic saline in those syndromes is well established in the medical community. It's also included in the Brain Trauma Foundation's guidelines. Those can be referenced, online, and it's become pretty much a standard of care. So overall, I think it would be difficult for an institutional review board to develop an RCT comparing hypertonic saline to, say, a placebo in this case, really because we've already established how well or how useful it is in this scenario.
That's a really good point you make. I really like that perspective that we can really only create those randomized trials when we're trying to figure out what the standard practice is out there. That's an excellent point you bring up. So our next question, looking at one of the other articles you mentioned, is that the Kerwin 2009 pilot study supporting your hypothesis. And is that the intended outcome for the pilot study? I'm used to seeing pilot studies used to validate methods ahead of more robust data trials, but didn't see any that followed that initial Kerwin study.
Yeah, absolutely. The Kerwin paper, it was certainly a pilot study, and they referenced that in the title. A pilot study, like you mentioned, it's typically used to validate how they're going to conduct the study, and it uses lower sample numbers, and it's really also another purpose is to kind of get effect size and make sure that the power of the study is going to be enough. However, you can still look at this paper as kind of a retrospective case series, even though there was no formal RCT or higher level paper that followed. And, despite its sample size, I still think there's some quality data there. It did show differences between mannitol and 23.4% hypertonic saline. And then even more importantly, it was one of the early papers looking at 23.4%. And since then, and over the last decade, there have been multiple retrospective analyses that have looked at its effectiveness. And, they at least, most of those at least show that it's as effective as mannitol in this setting. And we can get to, you know, why mannitol is not a great agent in the pre-hospital setting. And I think we referenced that in the paper as well. So,
well, I think we're all familiar with what a terrible idea is to give a diuretic to a hypovolemic trauma patient.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so moving from efficacy to harms, I guess our next question for you is that you report hypertonic saline in the hospital setting is usually given through a central line, but studies that you reference show no evidence of adverse reaction from hypertonic saline given through peripheral IV or IO methods, as long as you follow proper procedure. Did you come across any incidents of adverse reactions from giving hypertonic saline through peripheral methods? And if so, what were they? And where did you look to see if you could find evidence of adverse reactions?
We looked at the literature and we were trying to find like case reports or any evidence of adverse reactions beyond like anecdotal stories from other providers. But so to answer your question, no, we did not find any evidence at the time working on this project. However, you know, I wanted to use this opportunity to note that Dr. Rush and Dr. Rajeje, who are one of the leading authors on this paper, they've recently published a new retrospective look at adverse reactions of the use of 23.4% hypertonic saline through peripheral access. And that was, I believe it's scheduled to be published soon here in the Neurocritical Care Journal. And they documented, they had a large sample size, it was roughly 300 patients or 300 instances of that medication being administered in about 140 patients. There were no adverse events that they documented in that series. I think that further validates its safety beyond what we've also referenced in the paper. And I just want to, you know, bring some light on those gentlemen and recognize the paper and the work that they've done.
Oh, that's really good to know. We look forward to seeing that out there. And then finally, looking forward, what would you propose in terms of study design to prove that hypertonic saline is safe in a pre-hospital setting?
Yeah, Alex, this would be a tough question to answer and probably, well, to adequately power, more importantly, given the relative rarity of these events, specifically in like a military pre-hospital setting. Patients who sustain a severe TBI downrange is just, luckily, there's not really enough data for us to do a hard RCT analysis of this. Additionally, you know, I think there would also be significant debate as to what to compare 23.4% hypertonic saline to. You know, it's been agreed that I think it's no more of a gold standard than mannitol for the reversal of herniation syndromes. And I think the key argument here is regarding the safety overall, which has already been answered. And we referenced a few papers in the, and I, you know, the most recent paper that Dr. Rajeje and Dr. Rush published, that's also further kind of supports that. So I think from here on, you know, one of the most important things is to focus on this as a treatment option and how it could be tactically feasible for combat medics and ultimately help those guys, you know, save brain tissue and save lives.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Stack, thank you so much for your time and insight in this very interesting and thought-provoking manuscript, as well as all of the work you have done on the battlefield as a pararescueman and future work out there taking care of our injured soldiers, sailors, and airmen as an anesthesiologist. Thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely, Alex. Appreciate it.
Well, Josh, another successful endeavor here, and I guess we'll wrap it up by giving a fond hello and goodbye to all of our colleagues who we saw over at SOMSA. How do you enjoy the event this year?
Alex, we're recording this ahead of time. Like, I couldn't tell you. I could pretend. It was great. It was amazing. We cured cancer or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and sounds like you may or may not be there, and I will. Yeah, won't be there physically either, but I'm sure it's going to be yet another amazing event. And big kudos to Dr. Coatwall, president of SOMSA. I'm sure he's handing it over to some other amazing guy, and hopefully everybody listened to our interview with him. And really excited to have an in-person event this year, and hope everybody had a great time, learned lots, got invigorated, and please do reach out to us at
podcast@jsomonline.org if you would like to help. And please reach out to our editorial board through the website if you are a medic author who would like help writing a article, because we want your publications in our journal.
Absolutely. You guys stay safe out there.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.